Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting.
Location?
In the forest, near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
Yeah, one second, I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
This is WHFR, Dearborn.
HFCC's Associate Degree Program in Automotive Technology includes detailed instruction related to the various systems found on today's vehicles. This program is designed to provide students with a thorough knowledge of the technical aspects of the automobile and to develop a certain level of manual skill in servicing, testing, and diagnosing. Classroom and laboratory classes provide students with the experience and understanding they'll need to qualify in numerous fields of employment associated with the automobile industry. For more information on HFCC's Associate Degree Program in Automotive Technology, contact Instructor Gary Hines at 313-845-6350. That's Instructor Gary Hines at 313-845-6350.
Think you have what it takes? We do. Henry Ford Community College. Visit us online at hfcc.edu.
Ever have this conversation with yourself?
Local news and alternative views.
I know. You don't know. I know what I need to know. You don't know enough. I read news on the internet. You don't know local. I check into Facebook a lot. You don't know facts. I watch television news. You don't know in depth. I read the local newspapers. Better, but you still don't know background analysis, the real voices of the newsmakers. Then what should I do to really know local news and alternative views? You need to listen to the new WHFR Journal, broadcast live Fridays from 1 to 2 p.m. on WHFR 89.3 FM, or get their podcast from www.whfr.fm. So, now I'll know.
Disclaimer. This show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our Board of Trustees, or students.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Cotell.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. We have a special show for you today where we will be talking with the screenwriter and director, Joe Carnahan, of a new Hollywood film called The Gray, as well as cast member Frank Grillo. Afterwards, we'll get some green lifestyle tips from Avital Binstock at Sierra Magazine and some green cuisine ideas from Chef Annie Somerville. A new Hollywood thriller called The Gray tells the story of an oil drilling team struggling to survive after a plane crash strands them in the wild in Alaska. The characters are hunted by a pack of wild wolves who see them as intruders. Cast member Frank Grillo and screenwriter-director Joe Carnahan join us today to talk about the film. Joe, welcome. We're thrilled to have you on the show.
Thank you, Orly. I'm thrilled to be here.
So, Joe, we'll start talking with you a little bit about your process as the screenwriter and director, and then in a bit we'll move over to talk with Frank about some of his experiences as an actor on the film. And I wanted to start just by talking a little bit about, you know, what drew you to this idea? Where did it all begin? How did you come to be the screenwriter for this film?
Well, it's interesting. I was, at the time, I was on Mission Impossible 3, and this is going back 7 or 8 years, and I had become kind of dissatisfied with the process and was looking to kind of remove myself from it. And I think it was kind of a mutual accord in terms of I wanted out, they wanted me out. So it worked out beautifully for everybody. But at the time, Ian Jeffers had sent me the short story, Ghostwalkers, which The Gray was ultimately based on. And I think when I read it, it was so antithetical and so the opposite of what I was dealing with at the time, which was, you know, a big studio and a big star and a big franchise and a lot of moving parts. And I just was very drawn to this spare, pared-down, kind of bare-bones survival story. So that was the kind of the point of origin. And then in the ensuing years, Ian had written a draft. I went back over it and spent about 4.5 to 5 years rewriting that and finally getting it kind of into the shape where I felt like, okay, I can go make this film.
And of course, in the end, it did end up as a film with a big star attached to it a wonderful cast. When you started working on this, was there something in particular that drew you to these themes of wilderness and survival, anything in your personal life, or was it just the epic story that interested you?
I think it was my thoughts and feelings and more is about masculinity and courage and fear and mortality and all these wonderful things. And that I think if, as you get older, they become more important to you and they become more of an emphasis. And again, I think that at the time that I first read the short story, I was what I think was, you know, 33 years old, 32, 33 years old. And so as you get older and I've got, you know, teenage kids now, and you have a greater appreciation for and thereby a better understanding of these things. And so I was just able to kind of weave them in, I hope, in a very nuanced way, in a very a subtle way, and not kind of sledgehammer people with it. But I think also these are the themes that we deal with in The Gray are very common and universal. And I think, again, you're going to find something in there that is attractive to you and resonates with you, be it questions of faith, family, love, and again, hopefully all subtle enough that it doesn't become the tiny tail wagging the giant dog. But I think the epic nature of it, just where we set it and kind of the classic man versus nature, I think those are the bigger parts of the film. But what always interested me and was a very basic character study.
Now, you mentioned man versus nature. In the film, you've essentially cast the gray wolf as your antagonist to some degree, which is a decision I'm sure some of our Sierra Club members will not be happy with. But I hear that you were using the wolf more as a metaphor. Can you explain more about that?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I never listen. I'm a big animal advocate and love my dogs and love, by extension, wolves. I don't have any, there's nothing about me that would ever encourage anyone to go out and hunt wolves or destroy what is a beautiful creature. But at the same time, the wolves are very much defenders and not aggressors. And I think if these guys happen to crash land in a very territorially sensitive area, and I've said this, if somebody's in my backyard and I don't know that they mean me harm, then they got to go. And that's very much what the wolves function as. And as much as I look at the animals as a facet of and thereby a force of nature. And they are equally, they are akin to the river, the blizzard, the cliffside. They're all component parts of nature. And while there's great beauty and splendor, there's also hostility and a ruthlessness, as there needs to be. So the wolves are, and by the way, for those that haven't seen the film, I think feel compelled to attack it without understanding it in context. It's like, you know, the wolves do okay in the movie. They're not. I never wanted to demonize or cast them as the villain. I think it's very short-sighted and oversimplified to say, oh, the wolves are the bad guys.
What was the process like for you transitioning from being the screenwriter of the film to the director, and what were some of the interesting challenges that you faced?
Well, I think that, we're given a comparatively small budget. We made the film for about $25 million and shot in about 40 days, and that's pretty thin. So that was the biggest challenge. And as the screenwriter, you fall in love with certain things, and they seem very necessary and essential to the finished film. And you get into the shooting of it and the construction of it, you realize, well, the things I thought were so special aren't so special now, and the things I thought were incidental are monumental. So it's always funny how that works out. It's a very ironic trend that I found time and again. And as you know, when you work on a movie, that these types of things take place. But it was really, people have asked me about, well, you know, was the weather and the conditions we shot it under, and, you know, all the things I thought were necessary to make the film very effective. Were they a burden, or were they troublesome? And certainly they were, but I think I was so busy looking at my watch, I didn't have time to be cold, which I quite like. I didn't allow that kind of thing to linger, because I think if I'd had more time, I would have been reminded, boy, we're in minus 25 degree weather and hip high snow, and this probably isn't the smartest way to make a film. But I think that whatever effectiveness the movie does have is owed in large part to the fact that we went out and earned it.
What special accommodations do you have to make in order to shoot a film in negative 25 degrees?
You can't really make any special accommodations. I think what was great about it is it became a very communal experience for even the actors, you know, that they had to kind of inhabit the same little snow cat that didn't have heat and in between takes. And you have literally 8 hours to work in, because it's very dark, and then it gets very light quickly, and then it gets very dark just as quick. And so you had, between the hour that it took us to get up there, the 2 hours it took to prepare the gear, and then the 5 hours of actual shooting time we had, you really couldn't make any accommodation. You really had to kind of go with the flow and adapt very quickly. And I thought we did a really wonderful job of that. From the cast and the crew, everybody was really on their toes. They had to be, or we would have fallen behind a month on the first day.
Were there any particular scenes that really impacted you personally and your outlook on nature or the wilderness?
Yeah, I think, probably my favorite scene in the film, and I think I always loved the way it was written, and it sounds silly to sound self-congratulatory to say how much you loved it when it was written, but I remember the scene where the Diaz character kind of defiles this dead wolf, and then has, and again, with this great kind of hubris of the human being, kind of howls out at the wolves, and the wolves begin to kind of grieve and cry, and the alpha wolf, like almost like an orchestra conductor, kind of cuts them off and then howls, and then they all howl as a response. And it was meant to kind of convey that the overwhelming quality of nature and the power and the kind of the force. And I love the look on Diaz's face, and he realizes he screwed up. You know, he was disrespectful, and he did something that, against that sound, against that just raw kind of bestial, this chorus, that's my favorite scene. I think it conveys how I feel about what we do sometimes. And you know, at the beginning, you know, it's not an accident that they all work for an oil company. And I think we all, the petroleum companies are kind of when we think about who kind of sucks the planet dry, they're always, it's an oil company. And so it's that idea of industry encroaching on the natural world. And in that scene in particular, it really was a defining sequence for me.
I don't want to spoil the ending, but can you tell our listeners a little bit about what you were hoping to achieve and maybe what your interpretation is?
Listen, it's no coincidence that you've got two distinctly different packs opposing one another, you know. And I think what I wanted to achieve is, I think, you know, it's as important as how you've lived is how you're going to die, you know. And I think that I have a notion that I think is probably reflected in the film that's probably overly heroic and probably not as honest as I can be. But at the same time, I think that's your ability to kind of, I guess, for a man who at the beginning of the film doesn't seem to have much need for life, to be fighting for it so aggressively at the end is a testament to. I hope that that's how it would be. I hope that if something as precious as life, if I found it slipping away from me, that I would cling to it and fight for it for all it was worth. And I think that's really what the ending's about.
Now, you worked on this film for many, many years. Throughout the time that you worked on it, what surprised you about the process of making this film?
That I was able to make it at all, that it ever actually came into being, because I thought it was such a long shot, I guess, for such a extended period of time, because it wasn't something that lent itself, I guess, to an easy, beyond its the genre of kind of an action thriller. It wasn't, there's a lot of ideas and notions in there that I don't think are necessarily translatable to, you know, what you'd consider a quote-unquote commercial audience, although I think the film is tremendously commercial. And at the same time, my hope for the movie is that when you go in, that the film play a lot longer than the 2 hours it took for you to watch it. That's what I was going for. So that I was able to make it at all was the biggest surprise.
Now, what was it like for you as a director to work with such a fabulous cast like Liam Neeson and Frank Grillo and others?
Oh, it's the best. I mean, it was the best. They're all, you know, we throw that the phrase around, you know, kind of consummate professional. But then you meet a group of guys who are truly consummate professionals, and they just, there was no ego. There was no kind of pecking order. There was just a group of like-minded individuals that kind of went into this. And you know, I always say this, it was as much of an adventure as it was making a movie. And that's what's great, is that we were all kind of acutely aware that we were living our lives in that moment and not just in this bubble on a film set. That was extraordinary. And you know, and also I cast guys, these are all men, you know, they're not boys. These are guys that have lived and have seen the highs of life and the lows of life and all points in between. And so it was a pleasure.
Is there anything else you want to add for listeners about the film or the experience of making the film?
You know, that was one of a kind. And that was something I don't know that I'll ever be able to repeat. I'd sure like to, but that was just a really extraordinary moment in time in my life, and I look at it with great fondness, and it'll live with me a long time.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. It's been great hearing your perspectives about the film. We're going to talk now with Frank Grillo, one of the cast members, about his experiences and views. So, Frank, it's great to have you on the show. It seems like it must have been quite an experience making this film.
Yeah, to say the least. Yeah, it was probably one of the toughest things I've done in my professional career. It's also the most rewarding.
And why is that?
Well, we knew it was going to be a physical and mental challenge going up there, and with the conditions, you know, the weather was probably negative 20 on any given day, and the snow was 3 or 4 feet deep, and the winds were howling. But it was, you know, we were a band of brothers early on, and it was we supported each other, which I think got us through the day. But it was great. I'm from New York City, so it was great to be out in nature like that, in the elements, and to challenge myself.
So tell us a little bit more about the filming. It was filmed in Canada, is that right?
Correct. Yeah, it was filmed in Vancouver for some portion, and then we went to northern British Columbia to a place called Smithers, which is kind of like, if you would imagine, just exactly east of where Juneau would be in Alaska. So it was pretty cold.
Now, you mentioned you're a New Yorker. Are you also much of an outdoorsman, or was this completely new for you?
This is completely new for me. I love the outdoors, and I go to the country,
mm-hmm.
but I've always wanted to kind of be challenged by nature, and it was really revelatory for me to be out, just where it was barren and beautiful. So I look forward to getting back there.
Did it feel exhilarating or terrifying, or what was that like?
Yeah, yes, yes, and yes. It was exhilarating. It was terrifying the first day when I stepped out, and I thought I knew what cold was, and I discovered I did not know what cold was until I got there. But like I said, we were such, by then, a close knit group, and we all felt the same thing. So there was some comfort in that, knowing that we would help each other.
Now, what special considerations did you have to make as an actor when filming, since you're really out in the wilderness?
It was kind of actually to our advantage. We dressed warm, but as an actor, a lot of times you have to manufacture feelings or emotions, and it was really neat because the weather, the elements were such a big part of this movie, and we didn't have to fake anything, you know? So it was really just know what you had to do and go out there and let everything kind of wash over you. And it was kind of actor-proof, you know? If you could stay alive, you could do a good job.
Now, what was it like working with Liam Neeson and the other actors in this film as you're playing these roles of characters who are battling the elements?
Yeah. I mean, for me and for many actors, I mean, Liam Neeson to me is one of my, all-time favorites. I think he's one of the best living actors we have alive today. So it was a gift. And he, from the very beginning, set the pace and was one of the boys and continues to be. I mean, we're dear, dear friends. I love him to death. The only way we were going to get through it is if we made this bond, and that's kind of what happened. There were days when none of us could keep up with him. the guy drinks from the fountain of youth, I think, when he goes home every night.
Well, I don't want to spoil what happens in the movie, but there's a scene where your character makes a resolute decision, and it's very powerful. I'm wondering, how do you feel about your character's journey and how that went, how it ended?
Yeah, when I read the script, to be honest with you, I would never in a million years believe that Joe or the studio or anybody would allow me to play this role because he could have gotten any big name. These are the character experience themes and ideologies that, I know people like that character. I'm obviously not him. Just to make that... To show an audience a man who, is not bad or good, he's just maybe confused and afraid, and to have a chance to maybe make peace with himself. I couldn't ask for a better... I don't know that I'll ever get a chance to do anything like that again.
In that scene, your character looks around and realizes that he's just surrounded by beauty and he seems quite taken by the surroundings. Did going through the preparation for acting in that scene have an impact on you personally and your outlook on nature?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think if we do this right, the one great thing about being an actor is that, my experiences with some of these roles have changed my mind or opened my eyes to things. And certainly, it put me in such a peaceful place, those surroundings. And I have three young sons and who live in New York City, obviously. And, I realized the relevance and the importance of nature and what it means to your soul and to your spirit. And I since then have now, made it my mission to make sure that my kids are surrounded more by nature.
Now, this is a question that we often ask guests on Sierra Club Radio because we are a program of the Sierra Club. So, of course, we're always interested in hearing about whether you have a favorite place outside, somewhere that's really been special to you and has inspired you, other than, the parts in Canada where you shot the film.
Yeah, I do. For a while I lived by the ocean in California, and there's a peacefulness. There's a, the ebb and the flow of the tides and the smell. Whenever I'm in a place where it doesn't need to be. I could be in a grateful state of mind, but the ocean is the one place that I like to be around because it has a calming effect on my mind and my spirit, and I feel a lot more open when I'm near water, when I'm near the ocean. And so I've always lived, on one coast or the other for that reason.
Is there anything else that you want to add for our listeners about the film or your experiences?
I know it's a film where wolves are an element, much like the weather. We always want people to know that we are advocates of wildlife and animals and never wanted to depict, this was a movie about wolves that were really defending themselves as opposed to being predatory. And, you know, just that. I hope people have an open mind when they think about the film.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. You've been listening to Frank Grillo, who's here to talk about The Gray. Joining us now in our studio is Avital Binshtok, the Green Living Editor for Sierra Magazine. Welcome.
Good to be here, Arlie.
We are going to talk about Green Valentine's Day.
We are.
Valentine's Day is coming up, and I know a lot of our listeners probably already have made their plans or bought their gifts. But for those of you who have not, let's talk about some ways that we can go green for the holiday.
That's right. So the first thing you think of with Valentine's Day is flowers. And it's little known, but the flower industry is actually pretty environmentally destructive. Most of America's flowers are actually imported from Colombia, and most of them are doused in pesticides. And I don't want to be a downer with this topic because flowers are one of the most beautiful things that we can enjoy as humans. So to minimize your impact, consider ordering an organic bouquet. There's a site that's called organicbouquet.com, and they sell bouquets just as beautiful as any other site that aren't grown with pesticides. Or better yet, if you've got a garden and you've got some beautiful flowers blooming, gather those up and present those to the person that you care about. Or if you don't have a garden, you can bike over to your neighborhood farmer's market and buy a locally grown bouquet. And the benefit of that is you can actually talk to the grower and make sure that they're not grown with pesticides and build community that way. And then one last tip with flowers is that remember that a potted plant always lasts longer. So flowers, they wilt and die and you throw them in the trash or compost and that's that. But a potted plant, you can keep it at your desk, in your home, it improves your air quality and it lasts. I still have my plant that was sent to me last year on Valentine's Day, and it's still green and still thriving.
What other tips do you have for a green Valentine's Day?
So we've got chocolate, and we want to support the most responsible chocolate makers by buying organic, buying shade-grown, and buying local. And you can go to local.com to find all the local chocolatiers in your neighborhood or the local anything else that you're looking for. And some good brands to look for that are either organic or shade-grown or both are Newman's Own. There's a brand called Endangered Species Chocolate, and no, it's not made of endangered species. It just helps to protect them. There's a brand called Dagoba, and there's one called Ithaca Fine Chocolates. And there are plenty of others, but if you look for the organic seal on them, you'll be good.
And what about other Valentine's Day gift options?
Well, the Sierra Club offers a lovely one. It's called Sponsor a Wild Place, and for as little as $20, you can sponsor a wild place in honor of your loved one's favorite outdoor space, whether that's Yosemite or Yellowstone or the Grand Canyon or the Arctic. And your investment goes directly toward the Sierra Club's efforts to preserve those majestic places so they can last forever. And depending on the amount of money that you give, you definitely get a certificate of sponsorship no matter what the level that you give at. You can also get a John Muir-style rucksack that's constructed in 1892 fashion. You can get a stuffed animal representing one of the species that'll be more secure thanks to your gift.
Now, whenever we talk about gifts, we usually also talk about wrapping them. And so do you have any green suggestions for how we can wrap our gifts?
Sure. Well, first of all, you know, the best kind of gift is experiential, one that doesn't necessarily require wrapping. So, you know, a gift certificate to a vegetarian restaurant or a hike on the nearest beautiful mountain. But, you know, if you are getting a thing that requires wrapping, then, you know, there are a range of options. You can look specifically for recycled brands of wrapping paper. They're definitely out there. They're online. You can take a cloth bag or any kind of cloth that looks beautiful mm-hmm. enough to, you know, just wrap up your gift with and just tie it with a pretty bow and present that. You know, just look for kind of found objects around the house. Newspaper comics are always a fun one, though, you know, a little bit better for holidays than for Valentine's Day.
Well, thanks so much for joining us and giving us some tips for a green Valentine's Day. You've been listening to Avital Binshtok, the Green Lifestyle Editor at Sierra Magazine. Joining us now in our studio is Annie Somerville, the Executive Chef at Green's Restaurant in San Francisco. Welcome.
Thank you.
So we're here to talk about what you can cook from local produce that could be in season right now, recognizing can be a little bit tricky and different for people who are in San Francisco versus people who might be in the Midwest or the East Coast. This time of year, root vegetables tend to be accessible just about everywhere. So I thought we could talk about parsnips, which is a root vegetable that is often neglected. What would be some ideas for what we could do with parsnips?
Well, we're doing a lot of things with parsnips right now. And for Valentine's, we are making a carrot parsnip soup. So I'll just talk about that. And that is just get some big carrots. If you are very confident that your carrots are organic and you feel good about them, you don't need to peel them, and just chop them up coarsely. Get a few parsnips, peel the parsnips first, chop those up, and then however you like it. If you really like a strong flavor of parsnip, you can do more parsnip than carrot, but we usually do kind of equal amounts because that kind of just nice, kind of nutty, rooty flavor of parsnips really comes through. And so you have your chopped carrots and parsnips. As we say in the cookbooks trade, meanwhile, you could saute up some onions and or leeks, add a little garlic, get those going. You can add a little bit of white wine, maybe a little bit of potato as well. Once your onion or leek are well on their way, then add the carrot and parsnip mixture. Cover that with vegetable stock, preferably a vegetable stock, hopefully that you've made. But if not, there are some pretty good prepared stocks in grocery stores. And salt and pepper. Perhaps a couple of bay leaves. And if you'd like, you can add some sprigs of fresh herbs as well, or even just some parsley, and cover it with a stock and then bring it to a boil, lower to a simmer, and just cook everything together until just everything's nice and soft. And then puree it in either a blender or with an immersion blender or in your Robocoo or Cuisinart at home, and then until it's nice and smooth. And then you can add stock to finish to get it to the desired consistency. And then you can garnish it with anything. If you want to add like some big chunky croutons or maybe a nice gruyere or maybe a little bit of creme fraiche or sour cream or just simply with fresh herbs.
You've been listening to Annie Somerville, the executive chef at Green's Restaurant in San Francisco.
This has been Orly Kotel with Sierra Club Radio. To send us feedback about the show or to ask a question for Mr. Green, you can email us through our website at sierraclubradio.com.
You've been listening to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly program of green news you can use. For more information, visit sierraclubradio.com.
We've got a free astronomy class and an unconference for you this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome to the travel show that takes you to the final frontier. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society. A doubleheader today as we visit with planners of the third annual Space Up Unconference in San Diego. They'd love for you to attend, but they are also making it easier for you to find a Space Up gathering near you or to start your own. Don't know what an unconference is? You will in a few minutes. Then we'll find out how we will soon be able to participate in a 14-week online Intro to Astronomy course taught by our own Bruce Betts. You know him as my partner in the What's Up segment that closes every episode of Planetary Radio. And you may also know that he is the Planetary Society's Director of Projects, but Dr. Betts is also very much a Caltech-trained astronomer and planetary scientist, and he'll be sharing his love of the solar system and beyond with anyone who wants to watch. Bill Nye will also drop by to tell us a story about Stephen Hawking. Emily Lakdawalla is ready right now to take us back to the earliest days of a pioneering mission to Jupiter. Emily, I think we should talk this week about a terrific find that takes us back to a mission that really succeeded, reading this stuff, it seems, in spite of itself.
Yeah, we're talking about the Galileo mission to Jupiter, that these newsletters that were unearthed by Patrick Wiggins, who scanned them for me, covered a period from 1981 to 1997. It's kind of hard to believe that 1981 is more than 30 years ago now, which was the time it took to get Galileo from the drawing board to launch, which is just an incredible period of time. 16 years, so many false starts, so many redesigns of the mission. They actually nearly had to rebuild the spacecraft before they managed to finally launch it.
Was this because we lost a space shuttle?
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem is because of the loss of the Challenger. And up until then, NASA had been determined to launch most of its missions, most of its interplanetary missions from the space shuttle. But once the Challenger disaster happened, they no longer wanted to put a Centaur and all of its huge amount of propellant inside the payload bay of a shuttle. So they totally scrapped the Centaur, the shuttle Centaur program, which is what was needed to send spacecraft like Galileo and Ulysses on interplanetary trajectories. So those missions had to really be redesigned after that disaster happened. But Challenger was not Galileo's only problem. Galileo had so many other problems that Challenger was just one of them.
And I haven't reached that point, but I'm sure this goes right up through the famous antenna not unfurling. But you're posting these in batches, and I'm sure that's going to come up.
Yeah, it'll come up much later, because one of the things that happened with the shuttle cancellation is that they had to go on a trajectory that took them past Venus before they went past Jupiter. And it's so much hotter there, it was actually unsafe for that deployable antenna at that distance from the sun. So they had to keep it stowed until way after launch. So they had no idea that that problem was coming until years later.
Fascinating insight into history, and I suppose these only ended because we suddenly had this new means of distribution called the World Wide Web. Just one other thing that I thought we would mention. You crafty person, you've got to tell us about these spacecraft that you're creating.
Well, I was in the middle of a webcast and needed a model of the Dawn spacecraft, and I could do nothing but make a tiny little paper cube that looked pretty terrible. And I started wondering what I could do to make some better demonstration. And one thing led to another, and I realized that a medium that I hadn't used for about 20 years called plastic canvas. It's kind of like needlepoint in three dimensions, and now I've gone nuts. I've made Dawn, I've made New Horizons, I've made Grail, and I'm almost done with Messenger.
And it is a January 17 entry in the Planetary Society blog. Take a look. I've actually gotten a hold of them. I think you should be selling these, of course, but maybe that'll come later when we cut a deal with some manufacturer in China. Emily, thanks so much.
Thank you, Matt.
Emily Lakdawala is the Science and Technology Coordinator for the Planetary Society, a contributing editor to Sky and Telescope magazine. And you can now catch her, maybe not this week, but the following week and most weeks, Thursday mornings in Pacific time, 10 a.m. Pacific time, on the Space Hangout hosted by Fraser Cain in Google+. Time now for a quick conversation with Bill Nye. Bill, I'm really glad that you wanted to comment on this January 20th blog entry by our colleague Charlene Anderson, where she made this terrific accidental discovery online.
Oh, yes, the Cosmos Award. So last year, it was 2010, the Planetary Society, I was still vice president at that time, our chairman, Dan Jurassi, Jim Bell, Lou Friedman, we all went to London, went up to Cambridge, and we gave Dr. Hawking this Cosmos Award, which...
Dr. Hawking, would that be Stephen Hawking?
Oh, yeah, that's the one, yes. Brief History of Time and so on. And he was delighted. We had a great time. The guy really enjoys his foie gras, and he does. We literally talked about the cosmos and the possibility of unlocking the next secret of the universe and so on, and it was very gratifying for everybody. I think Dr. Hawking enjoyed it, and of course the Planetary Society was honored to be part of his legacy. And sure enough, the London Museum of Science features our trophy there in its display of what are called Stephen Hawking's curios, things that he's accumulated over the years. So it was great.
And Charlene really did discover this by accident. She's a regular reader of Alan Boyle's blog. He's the MSNBC science reporter, science correspondent. And she's scrolling through this, and there on in this purple display is our little rendering of Saturn.
Yeah, it's great. And, you know, the Planetary Society goes way back with Saturn. You ask young people, kids, you know, what's your favorite planet? Saturn! And so it's iconic. It's a beautiful thing. And so it's part of space exploration, part of this thing that engages everyone in the world.
Well, take a look, folks. As I said, January 20th entry in the Planetary Society blog, same place you normally find all those great entries by Emily. We will find Bill on this program again next week.
Yeah, I'll be at Arecibo, the radio telescope in Puerto Rico. It's going to be a great week.
Very exciting. Thanks very much, Bill.
Thank you.
Bill Nye is the Chief Executive Officer, the head man at the Planetary Society, as well as being the science and planetary guy, and he joins us every week with his commentary. Are you thrilled by space exploration and development? Do you like the idea of hanging out with a bunch of men and women who feel that same excitement? Or do you feel frustration about the end of the space shuttle program, driven crazy by the lack of enthusiasm for our push into the final frontier? Well, first of all, we're glad to have you in the Planetary Radio audience, but we have another suggestion. Get yourself to a Space Up Unconference. The next one is in San Diego, California, over the first weekend in February. I had a terrific time at last year's gathering. You can listen to the show I got out of it. It was our episode for the week of February 14, 2011. Software engineer, author, and citizen scientist Chris Radcliffe got it all started. He'll be joined by Mary Michael Sherrier, who is working on the creation of a SpaceUp Foundation. Mary Michael is communications director for the Space Frontier Foundation, which is always well represented at SpaceUp. She'll tell us how this new foundation is going to make it easier for you to hold your own unconference. Chris, Mary Michael, welcome to Planetary Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Chris, let's start with you, since you've got the most immediate event coming up. Third time around for this San Diego edition of the SpaceUp Unconference. Why do you keep coming back? What's great about this?
Well, what's great is that I really love the format personally. I started hosting these just because I want to go to them. It's a great way to get the local folks from the area, in this case Southern California, together. Everybody who has an interest in space, who's building something in space, who's doing anything space-related, and the conversations are just amazing.
I was there last year, got a great radio show out of it. If people want to go back and listen to that in the archives, really had a terrific time, largely because of exactly what you said. It is such a terrific group of people. This is really a new space crowd, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. It's a lot of the people who are actively doing new things in space. And this particular format, the Unconference format, tends to attract the doers, the people who are making things.
It tends, I guess, to be largely people who have some affiliation with the industry, if I can call it that, with space development. But it's certainly not limited to them, is it?
No, not at all. In fact, we tend to have a mix of people who are more on, say, the NASA side, the planetary scientists, that kind of thing. The people who are the rocket nerds working out in Mojave on rocket ships, that kind of thing. We have teachers and also their students who come. They sometimes provide the greatest questions and topics because they're coming at it usually from a new perspective. And then we have folks like me who are really just, I'm a follower, a fan. I'm a booster of all these activities.
What can people expect to do and hear if they attend?
Well, the interesting thing about an unconference is that what you do and what you talk about is all decided by the people who are there. So the big thing is that you invite everybody to be in one place at one time. You make sure that it's an awesome group, like I said, and then you let them determine what's going to go on. There are a few things that happen traditionally at SpaceUps. There's often the T-minus 5 talks, which go on usually in the evening or maybe to open a SpaceUp. And those are little 5-minute lightning talks that get a concept out there, and it's a little bit like karaoke. It comes on fast, and usually both the people talking and the crowd really get into it.
Not everybody's going to be able to make it to San Diego, of course, and the good news is, I guess the space op concept is beginning to spread.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we've got San Diego, and Houston is having its second space up. You can actually register for that right now. That's going to be at the end of February. This spring, we've got San Francisco and Washington, D.C. They're going to have space ups. In summer, L.A. is going to have their second. That was a big one last year. And then later on this year, we'll have cities like Boston and Minneapolis. And then there's going to be a space up Europe for the first time.
Wow. Mary Michael, in the very limited time we have, I want to get you into this because this is apparently what you're all about. I guess you're going to be there in San Diego, but what is this new SpaceUp Foundation that you're helping to get underway?
Yeah, it's something Chris asked me to help launch, and the foundation is going to be something that provides resources and tools for new SpaceUps to be born in different cities and help the current ones put on their events a little bit easier. The SpaceUps right now have to find a nonprofit partner, get funding, and all of that it's a little tough, especially if you're not used to running an event. So the SpaceUp Foundation is going to provide nonprofit bank accounts for SpaceUps and a little bit of seed money to get started and pretty much any other help they need, but without impinging at all on the uniqueness of each individual SpaceUp. If you are ready to go and you don't need us at all, then we'll just sit back and watch the show.
How can people in the middle of nowhere find out more about getting their own Space Up Unconference underway?
Well, it's really easy. You can go to spaceup.org to get information, or you can send an email straight up to me at info@spaceup.org. And pretty much what I do is you ask your questions about how to launch a Space Up, and I send you a big, long email about how to get started.
Chris, we're just about out of time. Again, is it the same website for people to find out more about the SpaceUp unconferences that are already planned, like the one in San Diego?
Yeah, absolutely. If you go to spaceup.org and you click on SpaceUp Near You, we have a list of all the ones that are coming up or being planned. And at the bottom, there's how to make sure that one comes near you.
Excellent. We will put that link up right where you can hear this show at planetary.org/radio, along with some other relevant links. Bet you can also just Google Space Up Unconference and you'll go straight to it. Chris, Mary Michael, thank you so much. And I look forward to seeing you at least one of those 2 days at the next San Diego Space Up Unconference.
Awesome.
Great. Thanks so much.
Chris Radcliffe is a software engineer for Measured Voices. Mary Michael Sherrier is the communications director for the Space Frontier Foundation, an organization that has been heard from on this radio show a few times in the past. They will both be at the San Diego Space Up Unconference, the third one coming up on February 4th and 5th. Check it out. You can join the fun. And we're going to check in, have some fun with our friend Bruce Betts, a special visit this time, not just for What's Up, but so that he can tell us how you can get in on his basic astronomy class, which is going to be online soon.
I'm Sally Ride. After becoming the first American woman in space, I dedicated myself to supporting space exploration and the education and inspiration of our youth. That's why I formed Sally Ride Science, and that's why I support the Planetary Society. The Society works with space agencies around the world and gets people directly involved with real space missions. It takes a lot to create exciting projects like the first solar sail, informative publications like an award-winning magazine, and many other outreach efforts like this radio show. Help make space exploration and inspiration happen. Here's how you can join us.
You can learn more about the Planetary Society at our website, planetary.org/radio, or by calling 1-800-9-WORLDS. Planetary Radio listeners who aren't yet members can join and receive a Planetary Radio t-shirt. Members receive the internationally acclaimed Planetary Report magazine. That's planetary.org/radio. The Planetary Society, exploring new worlds.
Time for more of Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society, and here... Wait a minute, what are you doing here now? You're Bruce Betts.
I'm sorry, you're the one who claimed you wanted to talk to me.
It's true, I'm just pulling a little showbiz gag. He's Bruce Betts, the Director of Projects for the Planetary Society, who will be talking to us about What's Up and our really, really neato contest. But that's going to come in just a couple of minutes, because we have one other thing to talk about, and that's the fact that you're going to be back in the virtual classroom.
I am. I'm going back into the virtual classroom after several years' absence, teaching Introduction to Astronomy and the Solar System at California State University, Dominguez Hills.
Thank you for getting it right for my former employer, my former employer's sake, up the road there, Long Beach. And we wouldn't be talking about this. I mean, we'd mention it because it's pretty cool. But what's really cool is that our listeners and others, anybody, can participate.
You can indeed. It is going to be going out live over the internet. And also the classes will be archived on the internet, so you can participate live. But yeah, it'll be open to anyone out there, not for credit to anyone, but in terms of if you want to tune in. And if you tune into the live showings, which will be on Wednesdays from 3 o'clock to 4:30 Pacific time, between February 8th, that's the first class, and May 9th, that's the last class. You can even call in with questions. They've got an 800 number, or you can connect via the internet, via their website. You can submit electronic questions. It will pop up on my screen in front of me, and I can get confused by them and misread them.
I have to practice my heckler voice.
Oh,
wait,
gosh.
Okay, now I'll do that when we're offline, because I'm definitely going to tune in. Now, regular folks like me, we can't take it for credit, but you're doing this for some young people, right?
I am. People at at the university can take it, but also this is part of a special program there called Young Scholars, and it offers college courses to you have to be in California, unfortunately, but California high school juniors and seniors are eligible to take this class remotely and do it for credit, and they actually show it in Southern California. They show it on many of the cable companies carry the class as well as it going out over the internet.
I remember watching a little bit of this the last time you did it. It's a lot of fun. It's a really great, I mean, how would you describe the course? It's a general survey?
It's a general survey course. So it's really, because of my background, not surprisingly, I will focus on the solar system. So most of the lectures will cover our solar system. We'll take a tour. We'll visit each of the planetary systems, out into the Kuiper Belt and the trans-Neptunian objects, but we'll also start the course after doing a tour. We'll talk about a little bit about telescopes, how they work, talk as I do here about easy things to look for in the night sky, and we'll also go a little bit into broader things, stars and how they work and galaxies and Big Bang and all that good stuff. So it's an introduction to astronomy with a heavy emphasis introduction to planetary science and the solar system, so it's appropriate for certainly high school, but certainly undergraduate, college, people who are just have general interest.
Do you want me to come in and do a lecture about string theory, the multiverse?
That would be
dark energy.
Great.
Thank
yes.
you. Thank you.
Talk about all the things we truly don't understand, because I get perplexed by those.
I'll bring Stephen Hawking.
No, but you can come on and talk in the show.
It'd be fun to do that sometime,
yeah,
wouldn't it?
Well,
yeah.
we can record a planetary radio episode.
That would be fun. Do it right there.
On
yeah.
Air,
throw the trivia question out, or a trivia question.
Yeah, I've got an hour and a half to fill in these lectures. I probably will steal some of your planetary radio guests and use them for portions of the lectures. I'm going to try to call in experts over the Skype line, as you
Excellent.
Like to say.
Yes, yeah.
So it'll be broad. We'll also have course materials available online, and it'll be good. And by the way, if you are just watching for fun, you don't actually have to take the tests or do the homework. Although I found, interestingly, when I did this before, people actually wanted them online, so we posted those on the Planetary Society website.
That's just sick.
So we'll try to do that this time as well. We'll have it on the Planetary Society site, and they'll be mentioned on the site. Should I mention some websites where people can find
us? Very quickly, yeah.
And then also we'll put real links in the Planetary Radio page. But we've got the basic sites for the course are DHTV, that's DominguezHillsTV.csudh.edu, and it'll be on there under distance learning. Or you can search for Young Scholars Program or go to youngscholars.tv, and I know they're still filling out the sites, so you may not have all the information. But February 8th, 3 p.m., first class, 3 p.m. Pacific.
Very cool. I will be there. Thank you. Now, just as a preview of the wonders to come in your course, tell us about the night sky.
In the night sky, there is blackness and light. I thought I'd do it in kind of a epic Greek poetic form, the entire course.
And that was yay, not Y-A-Y, but Y-E-A.
Oh, very nice. Okay. Very nice. No, but seriously, folks, in the night sky, got to mention them every week because they're so cool looking. Venus and Jupiter in the evening sky over in the west in the early evening, super bright. And if you can check them out this week, the moon will make for a lovely view next to them. It'll be near Venus on the 26th. It'll be near Jupiter on the 30th, making for that cool little conjunction kind of view.
Okay.
We also have Mars coming up around 11 p.m., looking reddish, coming up in the east, getting brighter as we approach its opposition in early March, and Saturn coming up later in the night and up high in the south in the pre-dawn. We move on to this week in space history. It was a week truly of triumph and tragedy. For example, in triumph, we had the Opportunity landing. So very many years ago, in 2004. And in tragedy, we had the Apollo 1 fire, killing three astronauts on the launch pad during a test.
Mm. Yeah.
Brum, brum, space rat.
which is exactly how you'll deliver all your lectures.
Yes, I will!
Yeah, I don't know. Lectures, I may have to appear more like a respectful, respected human being.
Nah.
Nah, seems unlikely. Hey, the mass energy of the universe. So, you know, what in the universe? 72% dark energy, 23% dark matter, and about 5% normal matter, which of course means that only now do you fully realize the power of the dark side of the universe.
I should have realized that was coming. I was waiting for the fiber percentage, but...
But oddly, no trans fats.
All right, we got this big contest.
All right, big contest. So the Mars Science Laboratory Curiosity wheel treads have written in them in Morse code the letters JPL for Jet Propulsion Laboratory. We asked if you were to put a message on MSL Curiosity wheel treads, what would be imprinted in the sands of Mars with three letters? What would you put there and what would it stand for? And we did great.
Yeah, a lot of nice responses. Thank you to everyone. As always, we won't be able to talk about all of these, just not enough time. But there were some terrific runners up, I guess you would say.
Yes, indeed.
But we have prizes for our top three, decided with the complete impartiality and objectivity by Bruce and me. I liked Ed Lupin's a lot because he couldn't think of anything funny, so he did IGN. I got nothing. Humans were here from Adrian Zyga. Leave no trace. That came from Ron Bask, LNT. I kind of like that. You like this one a lot. Cindy Thompson?
I did. Cindy Thompson with LOL, 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 which also is part of one of the themes presented by John Gallant, along with some other possibilities like wow and... And OMG.
Here's our top three, beginning with number three. And we're going to give Randy Bottom of Brighton, Ontario, Canada, a Planetary Radio t-shirt, largely because he came up with multiple entries and because he sucked up.
Exactly.
First one, RSF, Random Space Facts. PSR, Planetary Society Rocks. Now, of course, the boss would have us do that. But I'm going with BMW.
Bruce and Matt Weekly. I think that's... all of those deserve to be imprinted all over Mars.
So, Randy, big t-shirt. Not necessarily a big one. Maybe a medium. You tell us. One of those is going out to Randy Bottom. Then, from Bjorn Getta, Susan Noe. In Carrollton, Texas, another regular listener, HIC. Hell, it's cold.
They do that. They have to send it along with your voice doing that interpretation.
I would be so pleased. That would just be a big kick for me. They don't even have to pay me. Here is our winner. Our winner for this big contest, Bjorn Getta. And he came up with this, which is a sentimental favorite for me. RWH. I'm giving everyone out there a chance to guess. Time's up. Ray was here, as in Ray Bradbury. Now, the honorable mention here, I should say that Bjorn, that means that Bjorn is going to get the Livio kit. These great folks at Livio, who now and then give us a nice prize to give away. The Livio kit is their Bluetooth internet radio car kit for the iPhone. It may work with other devices as well, now that I think of it. But this is this really cool thing I showed you a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, it's
on
the
stock.
It's great.
Got nice buttons on it, and it goes right into your cigarette lighter. And it, by Bluetooth, connects with your iPhone and then transmits into your FM radio in the car. And then you can download the Livio application, which I think has like 45,000 internet radio streams. But it's more than that. Yes, it's a hands-free Bluetooth phone. So it's a really cool, cool accessory for your car. And Bjorn, congratulations. We're going to have the Livio folks send that out to you. I do have an honorable mention from my late father, which you liked a lot. Otherwise, I
did. It's actually it's my personal favorite.
Well, thank you. Here it is, KWH.
Kilowatt hours.
No.
Wait, no.
K Kilroy was here.
Kilroy was here, in reference to things that were the oddball phrase that was left all over the world by at least American GIs during World War II.
Absolutely. So that's it. What have you got for us for next time?
I always enjoy this. It takes a sick acronym brain to come up with this. Two of the categories of objects for what makes up dark matter are machos and wimps. What do macho and wimp stand for in this context? Go to planetary.org/radio, find out how to enter.
And you have until the 30th of January at 2 p.m. Pacific time to get us that answer.
Anyway, let us know what they actually stand for, and everyone go out there, look up the night sky, and think about sticky notes, where you'd put them. Thank you, and good night.
I'd put one right on Curiosity where the camera can see it, and it would say, Kilroy was here. He's Bruce Betts, the Director of Projects for the Planetary Society. He joins us every week here for What's Up, and soon in his class online from Cal State Dominguez Hills.
The European Space Agency's Planck spacecraft reaches a milestone. That's next week on Planetary Radio, which is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and made possible by the Kenneth T. and Eileen L. Norris Foundation and by the members of the Planetary Society. Clear skies.
The WHFR Monday Forum, an hour of a wide variety of one or more talk show programs from 6 to 7 p.m., some of which are locally produced.
Today turns into yesterday, leaving only words we say for this time.
New ideas and information, different each week, not available on other Detroit stations. That's why we're the station making waves. WHFR.fm. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to whfr@hfcc.edu.
The good times, the hard times, this time is our time.
The WHFR Monday Forum, 6 to 7 p.m. And also listen to all locally produced talk shows on WHFR Tuesday Forum from 1 to 2 p.m.
Taylor, WHFR, Dearborn.
Midnight Tuesdays, midnight to two.